Hi, my name is Father Sean Tunick. I'm the associate pastor at Curia of Ars Parish in Leawood and the chaplain of Bishop Miege High School in Roland Park. Today I'd like to spend about a half hour or so talking with you about a very timely and important topic for us as Catholics, and that is the issue of bringing our Catholic faith and political life together, and theoretically having a happy marriage between the two. There are all kinds of posts going around the internet and lots of things on TV, and it seems there's so much coverage about election at this time. And, you know, they say that in polite company it would be good to altogether avoid the topics of religion and politics. Well, I guess today I'm just going to completely throw caution to the wind and push the envelope, because I'm going to attempt to talk about faith and politics, put the two together, at a time when I know a lot of people are sick about hearing about politics. But I think you have to ask yourself, why is it that we get so worked up about these issues? Well, theoretically, it's because they're important. And therefore, it seems kind of silly to think that we would take the things that are most important and say, well, let's not talk about them. We do need to talk about them. And particularly, for us as Catholics, it's interesting that we have never been a religion that has tried to remove ourselves from the world. It's not as though we say, we're Christian, therefore this world is bad, we want nothing to do with it. Rather, we say a little bit that we live with one foot in both worlds, one in heaven and one on this earth, and as the scriptures tell us, we are to be in the world, but not of it. That means as Catholics, as the Catechism tells us, to be a good Catholic means we have to be a good citizen. And part of a democracy is being a good citizen. It means voting. It means being informed. After all, our elected officials supposedly represent us, and that means they need to know what we think, and we need to bring our voice to bear as we participate in the political process. But we do so as Catholics, and that's probably where I'd like to kind of start today. If I could break this presentation, this talk, down into two different areas. The first being that about our faith. And particularly, I want to look at some moral theology here, the issue of conscience. What is our conscience? There's a lot of confusion out there about what does it mean to vote my conscience versus what does the church teach. So I want to start by looking a little bit at conscience and the faith side. But then there's the politics side, and how do we then apply what our faith teaches us to politics? Now, I know this is a little risky, but I don't think it does much good to just give kind of generalities or principles only. I think, especially being so close to an election that is so important, as we keep hearing, that we need some practical, too. So in that second half, I want to get really practical and get into how do we apply our faith in voting. The first part, then, the conscience. Conscience itself is, it's kind of a confusing thing. You know, it's often we think of like that little voice in our head that tells us what's right and wrong. We remember the cartoons where a character's got an angel on one shoulder and a demon on the other shoulder, and they're kind of fighting which voice will you listen to. That's a little bit what conscience is about. But let me kind of give you this idea of conscience. Vatican II tells us that conscience is discovered when man, in his inner self, is able to discern a voice that is not his own, directing him towards what is right. Now, that's an important thing to keep in mind, that our conscience is there to help us. But I also like to think of conscience as kind of being our moral memory, kind of like when an athlete trains to get ready to play a game. You know, there's such a thing as muscle memory, where they shoot the same shot over and over. You think of the basketball players practicing free throws. They do it over and over, so when it comes in a game, it just happens. Conscience is a little bit more like that. It's kind of our moral muscle memory, if you will. And that's important to keep in mind, because a lot of times we think that conscience is this little voice inside me that's always right. The conscience tells me the right thing to do. And if I just listen to my conscience, I'll be okay. Sad thing is, that is not always the case. Just like if a basketball player were to use bad form practicing his free throws, He ultimately doesn't get better, he gets worse. I know this from my golf game. The more I practice, I think the worse I get because I don't know the right form and technique, and I worry that I practice the wrong thing. Well, we can do the same thing in the moral life. Our conscience isn't magic. It doesn't give us automatic answers. To some extent, our conscience gives us what we put into it. That's why it's so important when we talk about conscience, we never do so without also talking about formation of conscience. Now, that's a very important thing. Formation of conscience. We have to train our conscience, just like an athlete would have to train. The way we do this in the moral life is that we have to practice discerning what is right, what is wrong. And most especially, for those of us that would be followers of Jesus, that means we have to get advice. We have to humbly be open to hearing what's right and wrong, maybe even when we don't agree. You see, we have to, in all cases, realize that a disciple of Jesus is who we're called to be. The word disciple is a very interesting word. It comes from the Greek. Discipulos in Greek literally means one who is taught. One who is taught. So if we are truly to say that we are disciples of Jesus, that means we have to be people who are willing to be taught. Not people who have a magic conscience that tells us all the right answers, but humbly admitting we don't know the right answers. We need help. So that is the great role of the church. Jesus knew that to be disciples, you need a teacher, one who teaches. And that is the role of Holy Mother Church to this day, to help us form our consciences, to teach us. So one of the first things that is necessary to be a follower, to be a true disciple, is that we have to be humble enough to say, I will be taught. I think that's very important when it comes to especially heated things like tough moral issues, things where maybe there's a lot of disagreement. If we're truly going to say that we're Catholic, we have to be willing to say, I'm open. Help me understand what the church teaches. After we've formed our conscience that way, then when we find ourselves in a moral predicament, a situation where we have to determine what's right, what's wrong, well, we'll have practiced that shot over and over again. We'll know because we'll have ingrained in our conscience what's right, what's wrong. That's a little bit about how our moral reasoning works. Notice then that the moral life is not just about a feeling. It's not about, well, I feel really passionately that this is the right thing, or I feel really strongly about this. Our moral theology, like all of our teaching in the church, ultimately is rational. It makes sense to the intellect. So when the church asks you to be humble and open to form your conscience, the church is never going to ask you to believe something that makes no sense or that is completely irrational. Now, it may seem that way in the beginning when the church first is opening her wisdom. You may say, I don't get that. That doesn't make any sense to me. You could even say, I disagree with that. I can't understand it. Humility, then, as a Catholic, should allow us to say, okay, maybe I don't get it yet. But I trust that God is guiding the church. I want to understand why does the church teach what it does? And to believe then that there is an answer. I think that is the most important stance that we can have as a Catholic, one that humbly is able to say, I don't know it all. I need help, and even if I don't understand yet, let me work on it. Let me chew it over a little bit. Let me talk to some other people that can help me understand it. I'm going to look at the catechism. I'm going to look in the scriptures. I'm going to talk to a priest, to other people who can help me to form my conscience. Because the truth is, you can malform your conscience too. If you constantly tell yourself that something that is wrong is really right, well, we all know those people who have done that. The people that go out and commit great crimes, and we wonder, how do they do that? Well, they've broken their conscience. They've malformed it to the point where they no longer have a conscience that tells them the right information. That is the thing that I think about a lot when I'm dealing with moral issues, that I don't just immediately assume that my gut instinct, my conscience, is necessarily right. It has to be subjected to reason. Does it fit with what the church is teaching? Does it fit with what's in the catechism? If it doesn't, then we can say that my conscience is wrong. That's a very important thing to keep in mind. Our conscience can be wrong. That's why we have to form our conscience. And so with that little bit of kind of moral theology out of the way, I do now want to get practical about, okay, let's take our conscience and see how it works in the very dicey and politically charged arena of voting. Now, at the outset here, let me just say that I am not someone who necessarily has a horse in this race. I am not beholden to any political party, and I don't mean in any way to, you know, kind of cheer for one party or one candidate beyond any other. What I'm going to try to present is, in some cases, specific, and I'll give some examples. But at the same time, realize that I'm a priest. I firmly know that while we're supposed to build up this world, of all things, a priest has to live with that other foot in the next world and point people that way. As St. Paul says, our citizenship is in heaven. So one of the things that I always have to point out and keep in mind is that, you know, I'm not in it just to see our world successful, nor should any of us be. Yes, faith and religion are important, but I think all of us should recognize, as Catholics, that one is more important, and our faith is always going to win out. Now, with that having been said, you know, there is kind of this tendency today that things get really heated and emotional because we treat political parties almost like our favorite sports team. You know, we're going to root for them, and no one wants to see your team lose. I mean, I've been a Royals fan my entire life, and I'm going to cheer for the Royals even when they're doing terrible, because I'm a fan. But there becomes a danger when we start to do that in the realm of political life. When we start to break up into teams, like Republican and Democrat, and I'm going to root for my team, no matter if my team's doing bad or it's doing good. We've got to be, I think, a little flexible. Not beholden to a political party just because it is a political party or because we've always done that. We've seen some great shifts in allegiances to political parties. And I just want to get out there that, you know, I'm not really beholden to one or the other. I'm a Catholic first and a priest, certainly. I had one person the other day email me and accuse me of, I just favor tax cuts for the rich. And I was kind of thinking, explain to me how tax cuts for the rich help me as a priest. What possible allegiance would I want to have to such a philosophy? How would it gain anything for me? So I just say that while impossible, I guess, for anyone to remain completely neutral, what I'm going to say here is something that at its essence is neutral as far as could be any political party. Now, I think there are two key distinctions that we have to look at when we're talking about issues in voting. And this is where most of the debate comes. Maybe you even have heard the church use these words. Some issues the church teaches us are what she calls intrinsically evil. Intrinsically evil. Now that's a fancy technical moral term that a lot of times it comes across when the media uses it as, oh, intrinsically evil, that means really, really, really bad. Not exactly. You see, people are surprised to learn that in most moral issues, there's a lot of gray area, actually. When people ask, what does the church teach on this? What should I do? Most of the time, the answer is, well, it depends. Depends on the circumstances. Depends on your intentions. These things can all change, whether or not it's a good or a bad thing. Intrinsically evil means that it is wrong all the time, in every circumstance. Any good intentions are not enough to make it good. That it is always bad. Intrinsic means it's part of the thing itself. The very act is evil, and there is nothing you can do to make it right under any circumstance. That is what intrinsically evil means. Now, there aren't very many things, therefore, that are intrinsically evil. As I said, most of the moral life is a bit gray. But where this really comes out with voting is that there are certain issues, and even hot-button issues today, that the church would say are intrinsically evil. For example, abortion, the direct intentional taking of innocent human life. That is always, in every circumstance, evil, immoral. We can never do it. We can never support it. There is no situation that could ever make abortion justified. It is therefore intrinsically evil, evil in the act itself. Other things that the church would certainly consider today, euthanasia. We can't directly kill, again, innocent life at the end of life either, just like we can at the beginning. We would recognize the definition of marriage. We are not of authority to change that. God made that. Any attempt to redefine God's plan for man and woman is intrinsically evil. There are no circumstances that could make it justifiable. Those are just a few examples we can certainly call stem cell research that requires destruction of embryos, anything that would destroy life, really anything that lessens the dignity of the human person in such a serious way like that. All these things are non-negotiable issues for us as Catholics. Now, right away, we get kind of the accusation that, well, okay, now that makes you a single-issue voter. You don't want to be a single-issue voter, do you? Well, I mean, let's talk about that for a second. Certainly, we do not want to be single-issue voters to the extent that one issue is enough for us to endorse a candidate. Meaning that I'm looking for a candidate, for instance, that supports a tax policy that I like, and so long as they support that, that's enough for me. That single issue is enough to make me vote for somebody. Okay, in that sense, no, we don't want to be a single issue voter. But while a single issue might not be enough to qualify someone to get our vote, all of us would admit that there are single issues that would disqualify a candidate from getting our vote. Now, think, for instance, about the issue of slavery. Thankfully, a part of our past in our country. But what if a candidate today, who you agreed with on 99% of all the issues, they were your perfect candidate, but they were in favor of slavery? Well, we'd have to say, I'm sorry, I can't vote for you, and we'd think that person was a little crazy, that they would want to go back to those terrible days of slavery. Likewise, we could think of many other issues that if the candidate embraced it, for instance, they didn't believe in women's right to vote, but we agreed with them on 99% else, well, we wouldn't vote for them. We'd say, you know what, that single issue disqualifies you from getting my vote, and it makes me kind of question your judgment in general that you could support such an issue. The church tells us that an issue like abortion is such an issue. And notice that it's not to say that we're immediately going to kind of endorse anyone who pretends to be against abortion, but we do have to say that if somebody says that they're in favor of this intrinsic evil, that's enough for us to disqualify that person. And it ought to make us question their judgment a little bit. How could I really support a congressman or any other elected official that thinks it's okay to kill little children in certain circumstances? We have to reject that. And does that make us a single-issue voter? Well, yeah, I suppose it does. But all of us are really single-issue voters. All the church is trying to get us to believe is that the issue of abortion is just as big an issue as slavery or the women's right to vote, that, in fact, it's an even bigger issue than all that. It should be a disqualifying issue for us. And that's just an example, you know, of how, yeah, it's okay to be a single-issue voter when it comes to disqualifying a candidate. Now, with that having been said, I repeat again, most of the issues that we're dealing with in political life are gray. You know, we can go back and forth on some of these issues, and this is the realm that the church refers to as prudential judgment. Prudential judgment. That's, again, a technical moral term, but prudence. The virtue of prudence is the virtue by which we are able to weigh the good, the bad in a situation and come up with the right thing to do at that time. So prudential judgment means using prudence, that gift, to discern what is the right thing to do. And it may be different for different people. The very fact that something is open to prudential judgment means that two good people could arrive at two different answers. Unlike abortion, stem cell research that destroys embryos, euthanasia, redefining marriage that can only have one answer, other issues can have multiple answers, and people can disagree. And this is really what the realm of politics is all about. To debate. What do I think is the best way to do this? Said I'd be concrete, so an example. It's come up a lot. The idea of care for the poor. Now, there's something that we can all agree on as Catholics. Jesus clearly requires us to care for the poor, and in no uncertain terms. He tells us that what you do to the least of my brothers, you do to me. We know at the end we are going to be judged on the way we care for the least of these, Jesus says. So it's a very serious issue, one that we would say is non-negotiable. You have to have a care for the poor if you're going to be a follower of Jesus. No doubt about that. But then it comes down to, well, how do we do that? What's the best way to care for the poor? Now we see where, okay, it gets a little gray. Unlike abortion that has only one answer, don't do it, ever, how do you care for the poor is a pretty open question. One about which good people could come up with different solutions. For instance, one person might say that I think to help the poor, we need to create a program that supports them. For instance, like food stamps. There is a government program that has been created to help poor people get food. And you can be open to agree or disagree with that program, but it's one solution to help poor people. Now, we've also seen, for instance, we have a Catholic in the vice presidential candidate for the Republicans, Congressman Ryan, who has taken a lot of criticism lately because people say that his budget is immoral because it doesn't care for the poor. Well, we have to really back up and say, is it really that Congressman Ryan doesn't care for the poor? Not necessarily. Now, you could wonder about that because, in truth, people have pointed out, gosh, you know, Paul Ryan's budget looks like it's going to cut funding to some programs that help the poor. Is Paul Ryan immorally dismissing the poor? That's a good moral question to ask. But when you get deeper into it, what you find out is that, as Paul Ryan's bishop has said, Paul Ryan's actually a really good Catholic. Cardinal Dolan, the head of the USCCB, has said, you can't question that Paul Ryan is a good Catholic. He is trying to apply the principles of our faith. So you might ask, well, how do you get then to a plan that seems to hurt the poor? Again, back to prudential judgment. How do we help the poor? You can disagree with Paul Ryan's methods on this, but what he says, in his mind, I think the best way to help the poor is not to create a government program. In fact, the programs that we got, he says, are bringing us into debt, and when there's a debt crisis, it will hurt the poor most of all. Therefore, what we need to do is cut back and get our financial house in order. Okay, you can disagree with that. Catholics are free to disagree with that. Or you can say, yeah, I agree. I think that's right. What you can't do is say that it's immoral. Because from what we know, no, that's not what he's trying to do. He's trying to use prudential judgment and maybe two different approaches. And that's the beauty of political life. That's what political life is supposed to be about. One group says, I prefer this way. Another group says, I prefer this kind of solution. Provided that we all have the poor in mind, we're okay. What we're really trying to do here is balance two key moral principles, solidarity and subsidiarity. Solidarity tells us that we've got to remain in union with all of our brothers and sisters, especially the poor and vulnerable. We can't leave people behind. We're in solidarity. But then the question of how we do that comes down to another key moral principle known as subsidiarity. And that's one that we don't hear as much about. But subsidiarity says that when we make a prudential judgment as to what is the best way to function, we've got to do it as much as possible at the lowest level. What is the level closest to the problem? And so, for instance, in helping the poor, I can tell you that I've got firsthand knowledge that if you want to help the poor, for instance, in the city of Leavenworth, the best thing you can do is to give the money to my grandpa. Now, my grandpa is one of the heads of the St. Vincent de Paul Society. And so he's going to take that money, and when people come to him in need, he's going to meet with them, talk with them, get to know their problems. Maybe it's not really money. Maybe it's that they need a job. Maybe they need some clothes, and he'll take and drive them there, give them some clothes, get them some gas. That's the principle of subsidiarity in action. If my grandpa can handle the problem, let my grandpa and the other people at St. Vincent de Paul handle the problem at the lowest level. But all of us would admit there are some problems that are too big for my grandpa to handle, that need a larger safety net, we would say. That political debate is meant to be focused on issues like that. What's the best way? One of the things that I think is most frustrating about these quote-unquote single issues like abortion that immediately disqualify a candidate is that we might really like some of the other things that they do. We like their prudential judgments on so many things. We don't want to have to disqualify someone on just a single issue. You, me, all of us as Catholics, hopefully, wish that we would not have to be talking about killing babies in elections. All of us, I think, have this great wish. Couldn't we just put that behind us? Can't we just take that off the table and agree not to do that and then move on? Sadly, it's proving that it's not so easy to just get rid of that problem. We've really got to deal with it. I'm always struck by the fact, though, that there are 70 million Catholics in this country. One in four people are Catholic. If all of us would stick to our guns on these non-negotiable issues, they would be gone. Because no one could get elected if they didn't have our vote as Catholics, and if all of us as Catholics stuck together and just said, you know what, if you're in favor of these non-negotiable things, I can't vote for you. Well, very quickly, I think we'd be able to get back to the day when we could debate the real issues of prudential judgment. I hope that this was helpful. It threw out some key terms: solidarity, subsidiarity, the need to have non-negotiable issues, but at the same time, the need to have the gray area of prudential judgment. Again, I don't have a horse in this race, so to speak. I'm not trying to endorse any one candidate or any one party, but hopefully this gives us something to think about as we go about making our decisions this fall. What are the key principles that we really do have to have at heart? Does any of these candidates violate one of those non-negotiable, intrinsically evil issues? And if not, then what is the best way to achieve the goals that we can all rightly disagree on? Let's have that debate. And as we do, let's try to remain civil. After all, politics and religion, they're not bad things. They're good things. They are necessary because they are important. I pray that as we debate these important issues, though, we would always remember that there is one that is more important. Our citizenship is in heaven. So even as we try to live this life in this world as best we can, cheering maybe for our team, let's remember that in the end, as Catholics, we're all on the same team. Hopefully that's Jesus' team. We want to be forever with him in heaven, where there are no term limits, and our King of Kings is infinitely just. May God continue to bless our nation. May he bless all of us to be faithful Catholics as we bring our faith to bear in public life, and especially in the voting booth this November. May God bless you and your families.